Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the IBRI. It's our pleasure to host today's framework sessions. We hope in the future that this was actually our first sellout of a framework session. I think because of this topic, and I'll talk about that here in a second, in terms of we've been talking with BioCrossroads and Joe Beth, who hosts and organizes these. We'd really like to start to, going forward, have a good mix of scientific sessions, as well as general business sessions and updates. And I think based on the crowd and how quickly things signed up, tapping into that sort of need for more science types of discussions, I think is really, really important. So it's great to see particularly all the groups from the Indy Science Connect here today. So I'd like to welcome everyone. As I mentioned, you're at the IBRI. Let me just see a show of hands. How many is this the first time to be here? Pretty much everybody. Okay, maybe just to give you a two-minute spiel on the IBRI and the building here. So this is an IU building. It was originally called, or still called, the BRTC, Biotech Research and Training Center. The IBRI is all on this third floor. We've got obviously open room here for collaboration and communications and meetings and things like that. And just behind us, we've got probably close to 12 to 14,000 square feet of lab space, mostly wet labs. We've really not done much to alter the lab setups, but each of our researchers, who I'll introduce here in a second, are starting to build out their labs and take on research projects and initiatives. We also have half the space on the second floor, and we've made that available to startups in town. I think, as some people might know, the IURTC building, which is off of 10th Street, is undergoing some renovations and repurposing for a new future life. And there are a lot of startups in town that need wet lab space. And so we're very happy to have a few of those startups down on the third floor. We're going to announce probably tomorrow that Fast Biomedical is actually also going to be joining us downstairs. So as I like to say to people, mi casa su casa. We really want to make this a shared open space. We've hosted many meetings from outside. Many of the larger companies in town, whether that's a Lilly or a Roche, have had off-sites here. We've got some nice meeting rooms. So if you ever are in the need of space like that, please call us up and schedule your group in here. So I just want to set the stage. We've got a great discussion today. You can see My talk is really about how do you move. A lot of people talk about patient or bench-side to patient, and the translation and the discovery process involved in taking something from the bench to the patient. I'm gonna expand that a little bit. I'm actually gonna go further upstream, and we're gonna be talking about single cell technology and bioanalytic capabilities and technologies and emerging innovation that's occurring on the upside stream of that, down to individual cells and cell-free type of assays. Mike Puja is going to help us learn about that. And then on the far side, I want to take it all the way to patient care in terms of the use of what you discover at the single cell level all the way to patient care. And Alan Wright, who's the Chief Medical Officer at Roche Diagnostics, is going to help us understand that. And in the middle, where actually all the hard work gets done, we have a terrific speaker, Ron Shoup, who's the Chief Scientific Officer of AIT Bioscience. And he is both an entrepreneur as well as an extremely talented researcher and innovator. And he's going to describe a little bit of some of the wonderful things that are going on at AIT Bioscience. So we've got a great panel today. These truly are experts in their field, and so I hope from a scientific standpoint in particular, you ask them all the hard questions, not me. What I wanted to set the stage with regard to some of these science topics, so who went to the BioCrossroads Life Science Summit in October? A lot of people? Okay. Again, we ran a little bit of an experiment at this year's BioCrossroads session where we had two tracks. We had a scientific track as well as a general business track. And again, it was a smashing success. There were a lot of people who came out for both tracks. And this is actually a slide from our chief scientific officer, Rainer Fischer, from the Fraunhofer. This is part of his keynote speech. And I think, as people know, he's going to be joining us actually in 2 weeks' time. But these are some of the topics that, when he thinks about and reflects over the last 19 years at the Fraunhofer, these are some of the technologies and the innovations that he believes are very important for the future when it comes to life science, technology, and innovation. And what's very interesting is this is his list. And as many people know, we have a scientific advisory board that's made up of, and actually Alan is part of that scientific advisory board, but it's made up of representatives from each of our companies as well as the local universities. And when you ask them across all of their different applications of innovation, whether that's Dow AgroScience with regard to plant technology, whether that's Roche with diagnostic systems, whether that's Cook in devices and regenerative medicine, or whether that's with Lilly and therapeutics, you can see there was multiple hits on a lot of these different scientific topics and concepts. So the one we're going to be talking about today is really in this area of single-cell technologies and the diagnostics and biomarkers. I'm going to talk a little bit about biomarkers here to set the frameworks for this discussion. But you can see some of the other topics that were also very, very important, or scored very, very important from our FAB. And my understanding is, going forward, we're going to pick out some of these. For example, microbiome. We did a little bit of a session last fall on that, but I think we're going to be doing a deep dive in the future. I'm also really looking forward to this notion of big data, bioinformatics, application of artificial intelligence. Believe it or not, that was the very first thing that each of our life science companies ranked in terms of capabilities. And what I hope is that this will probably need a bigger boat to steal the line from Jaws. But I hope that this is something that not only can we bring our life science colleagues to the session, but also some of our technology. For whatever reason, we seem to still treat those things as two very separate, and they're not. The convergence that's occurring is just amazing. So let me set just one last commercial moment. This is currently our research team. We're up to 18 people in the Institute. About 11 of those are researchers and scientists. You can see we've got kind of three key focus areas based on that preceding slide. So Teresa Mastracci, who a lot of people know, she was our very first principal investigator, recently recognized 40 under 40, 40 scientists, but Teresa is probably the furthest along of all of our scientists because she started last year in building her lab. She's got a project with the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and she's starting to look at other projects in collaboration with others, particularly in this area of regenerative medicine, focused on type 1 diabetes. As I alluded to, applied data science was also a big important area for us to develop. And in this particular case, the first person listed up there, Dan Robertson, is actually a Lilly employee who was donated to the IBRI for 2 years, and we're working on a third year assignment for him. So he's come into the IBRI, taken off his Lilly hat, put on an IBRI hat, and has really been instrumental in facilitating a lot of the activities and projects that we're now doing in this area of applied data science. What makes it interesting is we are seen very much as a place in the middle, where it's kind of a safe place to do interesting projects when it comes to merging data. Our latest project in this particular area, which we want to develop some new tools and techniques and protocols around data, is a gene tox capability. To basically fail fast just based on molecular structure, and taking some of the molecular structure libraries that Lilly has along with the molecular structure libraries that Dow has, two very different, again, approaches to what they're trying to develop innovation towards. But there's a lot of similarities in terms of the way they have to assess molecules for safety, both human and environmental safety. So there's a lot of expertise in the ecosystem, and the goal is to develop a tool that would enable not only IBRI researchers to fail early, but also other academic researchers in their drug delivery efforts and activities. And then finally, you'll learn more about Mike and his Mike is our latest scientist to join the IBRI. He started in October, came from Siemens, 25, 30-year experienced industry veteran there, and he's got all kinds of ideas in terms of single cell analysis, microfluidics, etc. So this is currently our team, and we're very, very excited that, as I said, Reiner is going to be joining us in April. So let me just set the stage. You know, everybody talks about personalized health, precision medicine. You know, at the end of the day, everybody's looking for a target or a biomarker to basically go after. And you can see, you know, good definition there in the middle of what a biomarker is. So you're trying to understand from a biology standpoint, you know, what the target is, what's causing physiological changes in the body or in the system, whatever your system of interest is, and how can you look at that both in a healthy state as well as a disease state. And there's lots of omics, if you will, the study of different things around understanding what drives biomarkers from genes and DNA. So you talk about genomics, you can talk about it down to a protein level, which is proteomics. You can talk about it in terms of small molecules and other things that these cells and systems need to live and grow, metabolomics, and then obviously it's very, very important to be able to see these things and measure them to determine from a scientific standpoint what's actually happening. You know, why is it important? Well, you can see that, you know, if you look at it, particularly from a, let's say, a Lilly standpoint or even a Dow standpoint, you know, if you think of their molecules as drugs, you know, they're trying to discover, and you can see, you're trying to look at markers on the front end, as I said, what's going on from a drug discovery standpoint. You then move into translation, preclinical, clinical development. So this is all on the discovery and development side. Ultimately, if you're successful and you find something that works, you start to go into then more of the patient care side of things, with regard to diagnostic systems and screening. And then ultimately, you know, the goal is whatever you found in the clinic, if you, again, thinking of precision health, personalized medicine, that you can actually use that, and physicians and healthcare providers can actually use that to manage the patient in real time. Now, it's a pretty steep curve. If you look, when you're in the early stages, you know, you're talking about thousands and thousands of biomarkers. You know, and you can go up and they get screened out. And so, I don't know, I think Mike has a slide in his talk. I forget the numbers. I'll let you quote the numbers. But it's a pretty steep pyramid. And when you look at modern medical practice today, it probably looks a lot like this, that we probably only tap into less than 2 to 3%, if even that, in terms of what we can measure physiologically and biologically using some of these biomarkers as understanding health and pathologies, compared to literally thousands, tens of thousands of targets and biomarkers that are being explored from the standpoint of discovery. So this hopefully sets the stage. Why is this important? Well, you can see this is a Frost and all these slides came from Frost and Sullivan. But, you know, over the next 5-6 years, you can see that we're talking about going from biomarker revenues and tests and things like that to, you know, $8 billion to over 18. So in the next 5 years, this whole market is going to double because of the tools and the techniques and the way we're evaluating some of these things. And so this is really what Mike and Ron and Alan are going to spend some time sort of doing some deep dives in. So I think that's my last slide. So I will, with that, what we're going to do is Mike's going to talk for about 15, 20 minutes. Ron's going to talk for about 20 minutes. Alan's going to talk for whatever you need. He's our filler. He's our cleanup man. And then we're going to open it up to question and answer. So hopefully you guys have lots of questions. Mike?
Thanks, David. I appreciate it. So what I'm going to try to do is explain the clinical value of single-cell technology, and then go a little bit into what are some of the technologies that, you know, you have to talk about or do when you do single-cell bioanalytics. So what is it? A human body has roughly about 37 trillion cells, and we're trying to measure a single cell in a human body. And typically that's put into a sample that you get in the clinic, so it's called a fluidic biopsy. And what we're trying to do is develop the bioanalytical systems and new technologies that allow single-cell detection in a diagnostic type of system. So today, typically diagnostic systems measure at the bottom about 10 to the 6 cells. So we're driving down sensitivity 10 to the 6 order of magnitude. So if you look at all the IBD approved diagnostics, there's a couple thousand, so you're taking that number and multiplying it by 10 to the 6 when you go down. So new technologies can go down to single cell. The best example is molecular, where you can do a lot of amplification. But why is this important? The first thing, reason it's important is it allows us to look deep inside the tissues without surgery, right? We can do a biopsy of a tumor cell or a tumor by the blood. And the second thing is it provides that critical information that allows us to develop and customize therapies that are personalized. So I tend to look at fluidic biopsy clinical utility as a way to have earlier detection and better prevention. And if it was possible, you could really redefine the doctor's checkup from a cholesterol test to a place where you could look at all the circulating proteins and all the circulating or cellular proteins at a single cell level. And that's definitely going to allow us to phenotype patients a lot better. At the same time, we can capture the genes and personalize the time course. Because if you know a person's genetics, you can look at the time prediction of when you would intervene and how it would change and improve outcomes. And remember, if you're able to measure at a cellular level, the cell's still alive and still changing. So you can intervene while it's still changing. So those are the concepts. Where does it stand today? Fluidic biopsies are pretty much exclusively applied to cancer. And there's really two different types. There's the cellular type where you've got a handful of cells in a tube of blood. So you've got the problem of getting those 5 cells out of a tube of blood. So you typically do an isolation and staining, and then you have to look at it underneath a microscope. You typically charge somewhere between $50 and $150 a sample, and the turnaround time is about 3 days, and they can do about 8 samples a day with a technician. So the value there is really residual cancer post-treatment. And what I was surprised when working at Siemens is I found that 70% of treated patients had at least one cancer cell in their blood, which is pretty amazing. The problem with that technology is you need to know all of the proteins and all of the genes in the cell to really understand what's going on. The alternative approach, which has become more of the commercial approach, is to take the genes as cell-free. It's a very impure amount of genes, right? It's mixed in with a lot of genes that don't really matter. Clean it up and then sequence it. And that's typically used for pretreatment, which is just another way to get at what mutation is there, just like you would from a tissue, except from a liquid sample. Typically, they're charging more. The turnaround times are slower. So this has a certain inherent flaw to it. Problem with the issues, especially in cancer. And I characterize this by two different avenues. One is cancer's heterogeneity. So if I looked at 100 cancer cells in a fluidic biopsy sample, there would be 100 different clones, 100 different gene mutations. And if you looked at it in the tissue sample, you know, you would see mutation A and mutation B, and if you treated mutation A, you're causing a natural selection for mutation B. So the problem is you need to have hundreds of treatments and hundreds of diagnostics that you're looking at a single cell level to really combat the cancer in a residual form and make it go away for good. And then there's the cost of treatment and the length of cure. Like treatments of personalized medicine are $50,000 to $100,000, and how long do they last? A couple of years. So the other problem that we found when we looked in the fluidic biopsy with cancer cells is that cancer cells have sort of a stemminess to them. And these are actual cells from patients that we found in 50% of residual patients, we found at least one cancer stem cell or cell that had stemness to it. And it would mutate until it differentiated to the final mutation. And it has a safe haven. It can go into the bone and disseminate and then come back out, challenge your immune system. So you're fighting this changeability of the tissue. So those are some of the issues that are there. So the idea that we're trying to promote here at the Institute, or we do research on, is can we apply the same concept to chronic diseases, right? Why chronic diseases? The numbers of diabetics are huge. If you thought about pre-diabetics, it's even four times that number. And can we use this fluidic biopsy to look into the looking glass on this population and find the phenotypes and genotypes biologically to induce treatment, which would be internal factors, and at the same time use the digital biomarkers to look at the behavioral types of patients and the environmental types of patients. So, and remember, 68% of diabetics age 65 or greater die from heart disease. So it's a big problem. I'm thinking that this is going to allow us a new looking glass into this population. So how would you do this? So you would take a group of patients, typically diabetics or treated insulin or no insulin, measure them at year one, measure them every year, and see can you prevent tissues from dying, can regeneration and immune protection be caused, and can you avoid the typical outcome? So I'm just going to use the remaining time to talk about the technologies that you actually use. And I'm not going to go deep into it, I'm just going to talk about it generally. So the technologies that we use to detect single cells come down to detection labels, right? So, and the approach that we're taking is to use mass spectrometry as our method, and we're using mass detection labels. And the advantage there is we can multiplex. So instead of worrying about measuring one or two genes, we can measure 100 genes at one time, and we can quantitate, right, because you need to be able to quantitate. But still keep the fluorescent labels because we want to locate and image and see cells at the same time. And then use probes and antibodies to pull out genes and proteins. So those are pretty much the common detection methods that you would use. So we're not going too far out of things that work. The other thing that really helps is using nanotechnology, nanoparticles. And nanoparticles allow us the opportunity to amplify, so you can go from one binding event to 10 to the 6 binding events, where you put 10 to the 6 labels on one nanoparticle. And that allows us to do multiple labels and multiple particles. The other thing is you can use particles to isolate, to take 10 to the 6 different molecules and get them down to the one molecule that you want. So you have to do both. And the other advantage of nanoparticles is they can enter the cell. So with those key features, we've been able to develop, or these concepts that we are developing, are these nanoparticles that are used for multiplexing signals, imaging cells, selective capture of nucleic acids, and selective capture of proteins and peptides. The other core technology that you use, or that we're using for single-cell analytics, is microfluidics. Microfluidics allows us to do a few things. One, it allows us to purify and isolate cells and molecules and to array them into large libraries. And this shows an array of 10,000 different cells that are captured in the little tiny wells. You can use them as containers to contain reactions, to do systems biology, molecular engineering, and you can concentrate them and sample them, and you can put them into droplets, which is a big area right now, which is droplet digital generation, and that allows molecule and cell isolation and reactions. So the core technologies that we're working on here are for exactly that purpose, filtration plates, getting samples into tiny little volumes, which is really important, and doing high-speed droplet generation. So if we're applying it in the center, one lab really looking at single-cell isolation and assaying, and in this case, you use standard plates that have microfluidics in them, and you can look at the cells by imaging, and then you can spray from the plates into a standard mass spectrometer or into a miniature mass spectrometer, which is what we're collaborating with Purdue. But this allows us really this 10 to the 6 immunoassay, which you can't do currently. on a commercial system, and it allows targeted proteomics, so where I can look at specific copies. At the same time, you were able to isolate the DNA and RNA from the same sample. That's one thing that pharma's always wanted, is to have all three at the same time. Like, if you're going to do it, tell us the protein, tell us the RNA, and tell us the DNA from the same sample. But at the same time, the other core laboratory that we're working on is to use the same core technology, but to use it in what we call a digital biofactory, which is protein engineering and synthetic biology. If we can array cells in a clinical sample, we can surely array cells that are coming out of a flow cytometer, and we can use these as bioreactors and study large-scale systems by stimulating the cell arrays, incubating them, and then able to see on a single cell level what proteins are being expressed, what genetics are coming out, and what responses are occurring with the same platform. So finally, I guess, you know, in the end, you want to have a system that comes together that could be used clinically and changes things. And the idea here is this system coming out of Purdue, which is the mini mass spec system, which is literally a point of care system, could be used to make a decision on single cell proteins at the point of care, send the fluidic sample in and have it amplified, and then run on a genetics lab and get the information back to the doctor on what to do on the time course of treatments. Sorry. Oh, good question. So a point-of-care immunoassay has to occur within 10 minutes. That's pretty clear. Amplification is typically a three-day turnaround. So the important thing is to get it there stably and safe and uncontaminated and clean. And that's what no one's been able to do at this point. So, and on the same sample. So, oops, sorry, going the wrong way. I'm on my left slide. So I guess, you know, if I had to come up with a one-liner, I guess it would be, you know, if this technology could allow 100 immunoassays, single-cell immunoassays, and capture genes at a cost of a dollar from a drop of blood, I think it would change the way that we do healthcare. So, hope that's helpful.
Yeah, Ron?
Thanks, David, for inviting me. I'm going to go into a little different point along this trail from drug discovery to drug development. I represent AIT Bioscience. We're a bioanalytical CRO on the northwest side of Indianapolis. We're your local bioanalytical CRO, and we're very much involved at pushing on towards the drug development aspects of bioanalysis. So my customer is not only probably one of you someday, but it could, our customer is definitely the FDA. And so sometimes when the Grim Reaper shows up, you're happy that you have all of these systems in place so that you can defend work you did 5 years ago and help those clients go to market. So I'll talk a little bit about why the emphasis on bioanalysis. And, you know, this is really the glue that pulls everything together, that proves that things are working together, proves the formulation is adequately built so that it delivers drug to the target. And, you know, everything that we do in bioanalysis defends things like the quality of the formulation, drug metabolism, dose proportionality, sex-linked differences in pharmacokinetics, all sorts of topics are covered and proven by good bioanalysis. And really, when you get to the level that we have to strive for, these methods have to be fairly bulletproof so that people can make smart deductions from the data. this is just a scheme of that whole process from drug discovery on through to post-approval, when big pharma or small pharma has to make follow-on commitments to continue monitoring a drug through this, through approvals. And so I worked on a industry-wide, global industry-wide group in terms of what sort of methods are required. And if you would come to us and ask us, what types of methods do I need for early discovery or preclinical GLP tox or clinical? There are guidelines now in our industry in terms of how far that method has to go towards validation. How can it be qualified? Can it be a screening method? What's required? Well, bioanalytical CROs are faced with these questions every day, and our customers these days are the biotechs and the smaller companies that don't have that critical mass in bioanalysis, so they need that sort of support. So in a thumbnail, what do we do on the northwest side of Indy? We're developing both large and small molecule methods using mass spectrometry. We do ligand binding assays, so it's sort of an interesting company in that both types of technologies are under one roof, and we don't have any sort of brick and mortar separation between these two groups. The ligand binding assay people help work with the mass spec people in hybrid assays and vice versa. We're up to 50 headcount. We have a beautiful facility. Anytime you'd like to stop by, please come in and we'll show you around. We've been audited once by the FDA and they weren't as grim or reapers as we thought. We had a good inspection. And our starting foundation was electronic records. We're really the only lab in the country, if maybe the world, that is totally electronic in the record keeping that we do. There is no paper except for that manifest that comes in from a clinical or preclinical site. So every data item, every training record, every metrology, calibration, every stock solution, reference standard, chunk of work, pipette calibration from the day we started is totally electronic, which really amazed the FDA. Here's a story, here's the facility, a one-story building at 79th and 465. People don't think we do much work there because it's so clean, but we deal with picomoles and attomoles. We don't get things dirty. And our electronic records are backed up in Franklin, Tennessee, and so if the tornado hits, we're covered right up to the moment of impact. Hopefully that won't happen either. But if you put a study with us, the data will be protected. So, you know, these are the tools of the trade, both on the immunoassay and the mass spec, about $8 million worth of CapEx here, the buildings another six, the ITs another three. So we spent quite a bit of money putting this operation in place. Interestingly, compared to my prior life, where everything was basically dealing with preferred provider relationships and big pharma, we are very diversified among biotechs. And there are companies in this town that consist of ex-Lilly guys bringing a new compound to market. There are people in South San Francisco representing, within companies, thousands of people in size. We have quite a spectrum of customers, and we're very diversified. Nobody really would put us in or out of business based on that diversification. So just some trends in this CRO business, because maybe someday or you'll know somebody that needs to start thinking about how to get something to market. How would you do that? What sort of, how would you attack that from you're going to have to probably deal with the CRO because you're not going to have the infrastructure inside to do the toxicology, even the bioanalysis, the analytical. And in our industry, this early development part of our in outsourcing, the R&D outsourcing is about $6 billion. I looked this up last year. It's probably changed some. But you know, you've all heard of the big CROs, and the CROs are getting bigger. And we're sort of bucking that trend in that we're a niche CRO. We're looking to be the best we can be in one thing, which is bioanalysis. In all of these cases, you know, the companies are looking at their CROs to provide expertise and partnering and not just be a job shop. So, you know, we have sort of this bifurcation of the market. If you're in the biotech category, the CROs are your personal labs for doing bioanalysis or analytical or whatever the case may be. You don't have these resources, and you expect great communication. You know, a lot of times we actually evolve into becoming a project manager for preclinical and clinical trials, which is a little outside the scope of what we thought we were selling. But, you know, these companies, a lot of times they don't know much about that molecule. They don't know its stability. They don't even know sometimes what it dissolves in. So we're building up quite a expertise for them in terms of not only these analytical characteristics, but once we get into in vivo studies, what happens to that molecule in a matrix? Is it stable? What's the protein binding like? How do we develop bioanalytical methods of proof pharmacokinetics and drug metabolism questions? You know, on the pharma side, which, you know, our business these days is probably 90% biotech, 10% big pharma. Again, it's that capacity and communications, but they usually have the answers for what needs to be done and what that molecule, how that molecule behaves. So what's our platform just in general? We're sort of a three-legged stool here in that we have both immunoassays and mass spectrometry expertise and conveniently that third part of the Venn diagram there, the immune affinity-based hybrid techniques is where at the end we'll show a couple of slides on how those assays really pull together all the technologies. So our goal is when a customer comes in, we're looking at all the technologies, and instead of saying we're just a mass spec shop or just immunoassay shop, we can pull together various groups and come up with the best plan. So I stole a couple of slides from one of our scientific advisory board members last December, Chris Evans, GSK Biomarkers Discovery head, and we asked Chris to comment a little bit about what pharma's problems are these days with bioanalysis. And he said, you know, we're really getting stripped of our resources. There are layoffs, and we just don't have the capacity inside to do what we used to do. And secondly, that one in red there, his great desire to have biomarker data to help support making these early decisions in fast-failing compound. And he brought up a couple of papers here, you know, and he mentioned this one about three pillars of survival for drugs going on to phase three. And they're pretty simple up at the top there. You know, you think about these. Does a drug have exposure at the site of action? Pretty simple necessity. Does it bind to the target, and after it binds to the target, can it cause some pharmacological activity? You know, a lot of times, and we're getting a lot better at this, but 10 years ago, sometimes drugs didn't have all these things assured, and that's the holy grail now, is making sure those types of characteristics can be guaranteed. And I'm going to skip through a couple of papers here. This is just some biomarker data from our lab on looking, this is an immunoassay-based process where they're looking at whether this modified test article delivered the results depending on the type of dose, subcutaneous or oral. You can see that the oral dose in black really didn't look any different from the placebo, but the triangles on the subcutaneous showed an increase. And the delivery of that major construct subcutaneously in the circulation affecting this biomarker that we measured was pivotal to them understanding what they should be doing with developing that protein further. One of the other things that Chris mentioned from GSK back in his talk was trying to get biomarker methods that are reliable and serve as some universal method across laboratories with the same results. So here you see one biomarker being subjected to an ELISA assay on the right. It's hard to see, but the scale here is 20 to 60. The same biomarker being measured by LC-MS on the left going from 200 to 600. So a huge order of magnitude difference, not due to some mistake in the lab. But you can see the general pattern is the same, but imagine the pharma that says, we'd like to use this as some diagnostic case, and yet we can't nail down what true accuracy is between these two different techniques. So that, sometimes this is pretty extreme, but this is typical of sometimes where we have to continue as a CRO pushing towards getting this accuracy nailed down because, it's not just enough to show that maybe, and I don't know who these particular donors are, but maybe this one is indicative of disease and these are more or less normals. But you can't say, well, I'm going to do this test in Switzerland, I'm going to do it in Chicago. Got two different methods. We come up with different biomarker numbers. What are we supposed to do with that data? We really need to make sure these biomarker assays are accurate wherever they're executed and by every technique. So, back to the pharma problem. They're wanting these biomarkers to be much more sensitively detected. We have a number of great techniques, in which case we have most of these techniques at AIT Bioscience. The question is, how do you externalize these? And again, how do you prove that the results are consistent between operations? So it's a big problem, is trying to make sure that these things can be farmed out and reliably interpreted. So just to wrap up here, a couple of things about the nitty-gritty of what does it take to build a good bioanalytical method. Again, I'm still in test tubes with 100 microliter samples. I'm not doing single cells, but I find even averaging all of that volume into one squirt is challenging sometimes. But, these are the typical schemes that we apply. You're always looking for a way to get a cleaner sample when you're doing mass spectrometry. 20 years ago, people said, mass specs are so selective, just dial in those masses, squirt urine, diluted urine in, diluted plasma, you got an assay. That's like walking off the cliff, because that is not what's going to get you a reliable method. Mass spec is fairly selective, but ionization in that source is incredibly complicated. And there are huge problems with simple assays, simpleton assays, I should say. So what we typically do is some sort of cleanup, standard techniques, everything is done in 96 well plates. We hope that through cleanup and chromatography, we eventually pull out of those samples some very clean peaks that aren't co-eluting with suppressors in those samples that would cause bias and inaccuracies. And we use triple quad mass spectrometry, the workhorse of the business. Triple quads work every day, 10 systems. You just don't expect downtime because they're almost like UV detectors. They're just, at this point in time, quite reliable instruments. But, when you're talking about some of these more complicated hybrid assays, and I show in the circle here just for scale aspirin, single aromatic ring compared to an IgG, this is a much different can of worms to deal with. And so we generally have to resort to some specialized approaches on the mass spec side for dealing with some of these systems. And I'll just give you an example here, just one example for insulin. It's a nice, simple analyte, great interest in looking at not only human insulin, but all of these insulin analogs, continued strong effort in trying to figure out special characteristics of these modified insulins to provide ideal drug delivery. And just as a bioanalytical lab, what do we go through in terms of thinking through our options on insulin? You know, we could say, well, do we want to measure free or total? You know, do we want to look at, are there insulin antibodies out there in those samples that we need to deal with? You know, a lot of times people don't think too much about that, but maybe that's the tip of the iceberg, or it is the iceberg. You know, if we're doing cleanup, what sort of cleanup would we use? And then do we have a very exotic column switching approach? Do we use high-resolution mass specs, such as an Orbitrap or a triple quad, et cetera? So the approach we used, I'll show you in this case, is using an immunocapture system, very common approach, use streptavidin beads, magnetic beads, capture the insulin with anti-insulin antibody. We're working with Ron Boucher of B2S Labs to come up with purposefully cross-reactive anti-insulin antibodies so that we can look at a variety of insulins by this same one assay. And the approach is to do a peg crash of the sample, take that supernatant and go through the immunoprecipitation step, knock that insulin off after a suitable cleanup, and then direct inject. And so this is an insulin peak out of human plasma. It's about 10 nanograms per mil. This would be indicative of a insulin response after ingestion of a meal. The background basal resting levels, fasted levels, would be about a half a nanogram per mil, so about 20 times lower. But gives you an idea. We have lots of signal to noise ratio there, and a very clean signal. And what's cool about this is that, you know, other insulin analogs, by virtue of their different structures, are going to have different retention times. So the same assay can be used for all of those. Now, just so one final example of how these hybrid assay works. This was a slide taken from Jeff Duggan at Boehringer Ingelheim, a talk he gave last year. I just used it as an example of sometimes these antibodies have some extra baggage hanging on them. They're purposely built. Either they're antibody-drug conjugates or they have additional protein subunits, peptide subunits on them. And the interest in the industry is being able to see how this thing falls apart in vivo. So if you're looking at how would you do that by mass spec? Well, if you could pick out peptides that are unique to certain regions of this, you could look for each of those peptides. Remember, we have chromatography sitting ahead of mass spec, so we can do that. And so the idea in an assay like this, again, this hybrid interaction between LBA folks and mass spec folks, is to set up some sort of capture antibody that will pick out as many different forms of that construct as possible, pull them out with beads like we did with the insulin, go through the washing steps, elute. Now we have protein in a very clean matrix. We can subject that to trypsin. We cleave off, break this thing down to all of the tryptic peptides, and we're going to look for, in the case that I'll show you, four different peptides that correspond to four different regions on a molecule, a little different from the one that I showed previously. And you can see that the exquisite sensitivity of mass spec here, you can look at low picogram amounts of these peptides. Each of these peptides came from different regions of the construct, and then those things can be used. They're follow those as basically derivatives of the protein and watch the pharmacokinetics of these surrogate peptides as your biomarkers for that region of the protein. And just last slide here, incredible precision, good linearity. This was a 50 nanogram per mil sample of a protein that was heading towards 200 kilodaltons in size. And by looking at each of these peptides, we can generate similar calibration curves, and we can be looking for whether one part of that protein might be dropping off prematurely. So just some things about what we do at AIT. We're doing novel things with proteins and peptides. We're doing small molecules, just the whole opposite end of the spectrum. Somebody wanted us to measure urea by mass spec. I don't know. It seems rather overkill. But you know, we go from the very big to the very small and all sizes in between. And with that, I'll hand it to Alan.
Thanks, Ron. How much time do I get? This is kind of like name that tune. I can give this speech in, I have 15 minutes. Is that true? So I don't have any slides, and I'm going to speak about what would be the final mile in technology. We've heard about great discoveries here. We've been talking about bench to bedside, but really the final mile is bedside to community. And what we're talking about here is technology diffusion. And how do we get these great discoveries out into the community? A few years back, there was a paper that described the diffusion of hemoglobin A1C. We take it for granted now that it is essential in the management of diabetics and diabetes care. But in fact, it took 17 years for hemoglobin A1C to be broadly adopted by the community. And the real question here is, how can we compress that adoption? How can we get these great discoveries that the people who are knowledgeable in the field agree are important for medical care, how can we push them out to the furthest reaches of the community? And at Roche, what we talk about really are three trends. One is technology closer to the patient. That is a trend that continuously happens. Two, an emphasis on knowledge that matters. How can we talk about what these technologies provide? And three, and I think this is the most recent trend, is information technology everywhere. And a technology that is created without that in mind is going nowhere in the future. So first, let's talk about technology closer to the patient. And you know, the most obvious thing and one of the conclusions people immediately leap to is make it smaller, make it point of care. So I'm going to pick on mass spec. I know you like it. It is giant. Those suckers are like, you stack two of those tables on top of each other, then you need a technician to live with that machine, that individual machine, for a year, and then it can start performing. But what we're seeing in innovative centers is that they are starting to shrink. They're getting smaller. The price tag of $750,000 a piece is getting less, and they are getting a lot smaller. You know, one of the things I want to bring up is that the juxtaposition of life sciences with a heavy tradition of engineering really makes Indiana ideal for this kind of thing. Plus, companies like Roche's job really is to push things out into the community. You know, that continuum is very important for technologies in the future. Another example is a polymerase chain reaction, PCR, really a staple of medical care right now. We have a cobas 4800. Don't ask me what a cobas is, but again, it's the size of one of those tables. We now have a PCR machine that has the same level of performance. Remember the Fat Mac, that cute little, it's the size of the Fat Mac, and it can do PCR in 20 minutes with the same speed and accuracy. But aside from point of care and making things small, to give patients access is also turnaround time. And let me pick on sequencing. Now, you see, I'm a, you know, full-service abuser here. Sequencing, while really unlocking science of the cell and we're making great discoveries, that is an immature, fussy technology available only in university centers. You go 200 miles outside of a metropolitan center, you don't have access to sequencing. And the question is, how do we make sequencing simple enough where it is sample in, result out? And that needs to be addressed in all technologies in the future. Also with sequencing is turnaround time. It's slow. You know, it can be used for cancer, which is a slowly evolving disease, and you can wait, you know, 2-3 weeks to get your result. But for rapidly evolving situations, sequencing is essentially unavailable. So if you have a sequencing solution that really addresses a rapidly evolving problem, can't use it right now. And how do we make that faster? Another thing with technologies is new and better samples. So we heard about the single cell technology where you're going from a biopsy, which involves surgery, cutting people open, taking pieces of them out, to blood tests. But it's evolving even further than that. Think of breath as an ultra, a volatile fraction of serum. You know, we already do that with breathalyzer, but there are other molecules in breath that can be measured, or saliva, and other much more accessible sample technologies. And finally, the devices themselves, not only the size, but the durability. Here in North America, we have a luxury of, you know, reliable electricity. Most of the world, in fact, does not have reliable electricity. And how does an instrument hold up or a technology hold up with surges in electricity? The other thing is cold chain. Can you keep things cold reliably at a consistent temperature over time, and developing technologies so that they're durable enough that you can push them all the way out to the patient and they don't require robust cold chains or robust consistent electricity? And when you get all of that, that's the characteristic: small, simple, reliable. That is the kind of device or technology that you can push out. But there's another component to that, two other components to that. The second is knowledge that matters. And one of the things that is happening increasingly, even from the genesis of an idea, what is the clinical utility? What is the ultimate use of that in delivering care? How does that benefit the patient? And starting all the way back, it's not science for just science anymore. It really needs to be much more focused and much more purpose-built discovery. And including that is very important. But there's other things, too, that happen with knowledge that matters. There's large parts of the world, for instance, that don't have pathologists. So, for instance, there are 28,000 pathologists in the world. The United States has 17,000 of them. So if you live in the Ukraine or Moldova, you have an internist reading your biopsy rather than a pathologist. So how can we use artificial intelligence, image recognition, to take those results, to take those biopsy specimens, to turn them in to a better read, to give access for patients? So using artificial intelligence, point of care, decision support, and newer computational techniques to enhance the use of these technologies to push them out into the periphery. So simple things like an understandable clinical value proposition or social value proposition that begins with the beginning of discovery all the way up to sophisticated analysis to simplify the assessment to make it available to caregivers is an important thing. Finally, information technology everywhere. And while it is easy to say, oh, well, that makes sense in our environment, you realize that 80% of the people in the world have access to a cell phone now with that immense computational power that smartphones have. So it is not necessarily a developed world consideration here, but the availability of smartphones and the availability of internet and networks and the internet of things, devices and technologies in the future must be able to fit into that network and fit into the much more complicated interconnected electronic milieu that are springing up throughout the healthcare delivery systems. And as this is one of the emphases that we have at Roche right now. Traditionally, we've built instruments and devices, mostly in the basement of the science building. And the idea is to get those laboratorians familiar with information technology, the quality of their data, and how to project that up into the cloud and use that in decision support. And it's not only testing from analyzers, but it's incorporating other things from wearable technologies, cardiac monitors, Fitbits. You know, the amount of sensors that are becoming available, you assume that a sensor will be available. You request, I need this kind of sensor. You give it to, you know, some millennial somewhere on a beanbag chair, and they'll come back in 6 months with the solution for that. So assume that in information technology and the integrative approach of these different data streams to support decisions. So what we're working on to drive technology diffusion, and it's very important when you talk about personalized healthcare, which is a combination of a companion diagnostic with a companion therapeutic, is how do you drive that diagnostic and the understanding of that diagnostic to an appropriate level in the community so the community can have access, everyone can have access to those technologies. And that concludes my prepared remarks.
So with that, we'll... Let me see. I'll turn off the projector so we don't have to stand and or stare in the to the light here. Or maybe I can. There we go. And if the here we can bring these up here. Yeah, we'll be like there you go. Any questions for? Our panelists, based on their, let me judge time too. How much time do we have? About 10 minutes? About 20 minutes. Oh, okay. So, any, Suzanne?
Culturally, sometimes collecting a, there are differences culturally in collecting a biopsy or VT.
Mm-hmm.
which would really allow a lot more patients to then explore their treatment options. So how close do you think we are, and do you think the microfluidics are going to be the solution?
I think we're fairly close. I mean, we were definitely doing lung cancer, ALK mutations, and PD-L1 on a single cell level, and we were finding cells in 70% of the patients who were treated. So the problem really is the heterogeneity, you know, that every cell is different, and so, you know, do you need 100 different cells and 100 different markers? And that's why we really wanted to go to a multiplex solution. But I still think the system biology problem with cancer is still there. It's mutatable and it's heterogeneic, and that's going to always be a problem. The fluidic biopsy cell-free stuff has an issue in that it requires basically a center, you know, a large amount of tumor mass to go into the blood before you even do that. And as Ellen mentioned, the sequencing stuff is a nightmare. To clean up, and you're really pretty much, you know, better off getting the tissue. But it is attractive. If you pick up 10% more patients with, you know, then it becomes attractive to a pharma company.
We actually had it. For Tarceva, we had a circulating tumor cell test using PCR. Which is faster than sequencing. It's about 70% sensitive. So if you turn up negative with a mutation that is targeted for Tarceva, you still need to go to biopsy. But 70% of the time, somebody with a mass, with a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer, we can if it's positive, we can save the use of that tumor. As far as moving to diagnosis with circulating cell-free DNA or circulating tumor cells, you know, frankly, we don't understand enough of the cancer biology to work with that. And we have a lot of cell-free DNA projects underway with other companies. Probably you.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I want to
know. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Another question, Brian.
Alan, I have a question. You talked about some research technology that is used towards the bedside and that kind of mixed success, mass spec, sequencing, etc. Is there ever a role that flow cytometry might move closer to a patient, or is that something? I've read a little bit about that, but I didn't know if it's a pipe dream or something
that... No. We're seeing, the innovation is happening everywhere, and there's certainly innovation in flow cytometry, and we see it is a common research tool in life sciences, and you know already that it's very commonly used in hematopoietic tumors. I look at a lot of innovation. I haven't seen a broad community focused application of flow cytometry recently. But I wouldn't be surprised if somebody comes in and says, hey, you know, we now have a flow cytometer that's this big and it's used specifically for this issue. What kind of viral diseases? Because we hepatitis C is probably one of our biggest sellers, as is B. We have a very, you know, human papillomavirus, which is certainly used frequently. We have solutions for influenza A. You know, I can't there's a lot of work. Plus, I think a cool thing is Zika. We the whole Zika story and the rapid development when the diagnostic industry came together, and I think Siemens now has an IgM for Zika, and we have a PCR test. So I think there is an emphasis. In fact, I think virology is more palatable to the big diagnostic industry because it's a bigger, much bigger market. It's a giant market. When you look at something like lung cancer, there are 150,000 new cases a year. Probably 100,000 of those are metastatic and require diagnosis. That is a relatively small market. It is top of mind because it's such a dreadful, fearsome disease, and there's a lot of innovation. But there's as far as just the market propelling innovation, certainly virology is right up there.
Right. Yeah.
Sure, sure. But, you know, again, this gets to my point in knowledge that matters. So if I tell you you have a coronavirus infection, you know, and that's why you feel bad for 5 days, what do you do?
There is a connection in the microbiome research that's going on right now, which is, you know, single cell genetics and really starting to look at cultures like upper respiratory tract infections as not individual bacteria isolates, but groups of isolates. And I think that's how do the cells talk to each other, how do they talk and transform our tissues, how do they induce immune responses. And then looking at the immune response on a single cell level is pretty much an active topic, I think, in infectious diseases today.
Hi, Ellen. This question is for you. In your diabetes care, I know that you have really leveraged devices and IoT and apps.
Right.
Have you explored how you can actually leverage power of IoT and all? In the diagnostic side, you get them at point of care, devices becoming smaller and smaller. So
right.
It's like a self-serving devices and IoT applications.
We have a couple of initiatives with that. So we have a interest in clinical decision support, so leveraging information coming out of electronic medical records and combining that with information coming from the laboratory information system, and how can you combine information to provide a recommendation for a physician. That is a multifaceted issue because I think in the near future, the FDA will get involved in those clinical decision support rules, and we'll have to work through the regulatory science on developing and deploying those rules. But there's a lot of levels in deploying that type of clinical decision support, already from all the way from sociology or the culture of physicians and sort of alert fatigue to you know, what is a good, robust decision support rule that's right and provides the right recommendations all the way down to the research, and how do you curate those and maintain that they're accurate. We also have an initiative looking at just big data, static data sets, and one of the things that's happening, particularly in sequencing is evolving so quickly that the availability of robust, traditional set piece randomized controlled trials for sequence just isn't happening. It's mostly observational data, real world data, and the FDA is trying to figure out how to use those data in their approval process. So we're looking into using real-world data for submittals and providing evidence to support diagnostics. Another thing that we're looking at is improving our telemetry on our devices. So when you're flying in an airplane, that jet engine is, you know, releasing telemetry all the time. Our machines do as well. And, you know, how can we improve things like mean time to failure of some little, you know, sprocket in there and develop that. And then finally, how do we better display information to physicians? How do we make it visually attractive? How does their it's sort of like computer games. How do their eyes move across the screen, and how to, you know, and thinking about that as well. So yeah, we have a significant interest in that.
Ron, I was going to ask you a question. What's your typical project in terms of what you get to start? I mean, I'm trying to think about the multiple customers and clients that you have. You've got a relatively small organization.
Right.
How do you, you know,
We're given a molecule with some objectives, and typically maybe somebody has fiddled with it in a university laboratory without more than one page of information. So we're looking at the, and thank God we're given the structure. But there's a few companies that think they we can develop things without knowing what the structure is, which makes it real challenging. So typically we know structure. We look at it from what groups on this might be susceptible to decomposition or metabolism. We start out with 10 or 20 milligrams and roll up our sleeves and start getting things optimized.
And how much, I mean, obviously a heavy chemistry focus, but
right.
How well is the biology understood when it comes to you? And
well, that's one area that we as a company are evolving into, hiring people with more of a biology focus and less hard physical chemistry guys like me that that really have focused more on chemistry and mass spectrometry. And so to get that, generally they don't know, a lot of them don't know much about what's going on biologically either. They may have been, they may have purchased this molecule as maybe a second tier or lost opportunity from a pharma.
Mm-hmm.
And there are great reports there that give us a good head start, but maybe those reports are 5-10 years old and they need serious updating.
Mm-hmm.
So we work through all of those issues with them.
And you know, Alan talked a lot about sort of information in the clouds and some of these other other informatic sources. Do you get involved in integrating any of that, or is that all done at the client, on the client?
Back to the client, and generally there's a central CRO that's involved with managing clinical trials and working up the larger database of information on that program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Keep going, Ron, on your talent strategy. As you look at the types of skills that you're starting to describe there, start to wrap those up, what universities in Indiana, one university in the Midwest and in the United States, are you sourcing most of your people from? Where's your talent?
We're an equal opportunity employer. my wife has two Purdue degrees. I have two Purdue degrees. We love IU graduates. We hire from a variety of places, and I'm just thinking my last hires were Florida and Iowa State, two PhDs. Indianapolis is a very rich area for finding talent. I used to work in West Lafayette, my prior company, and there was always a good number of people with some connection to Purdue. But it was more difficult And we found them. In fact, we were more international in our employment in West Lafayette than we are in Indy. We had a Chinese employees club, you know, so there was a lot of diversification there. But here we're we find people from, there's no one category that we're looking. We have Butler grads, we have Marion University grads, Wabash.
So our state is a rich source for you. What percent of, obviously you want to have some cross-referencing of skills,
sure,
and knowledge. What percent of your employees are coming from Indiana, roughly?
Oh, I don't know. Terry, you got a number for that? I don't know. Terry's our CEO. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
The guy that heads up our ligand binding assay group, very interesting, grew up in northwestern Ohio, got degrees somewhere in the state of Ohio, worked at a biotech in Cincinnati, in Connecticut. Then he went to Amgen, Thousand Oaks, didn't like the West Coast. Okay, so then he moves to the East Coast, works for Groton for Pfizer, goes up to Andover, gets passed around through the Pfizer reorganization route, you know, and eventually says, I'm ready to leave the Northeast, and he lands in Indianapolis. So, interesting background, lots of big pharma experience, knows antibody drug conjugates, knows ligand binding assays backwards and forwards. That's the sort of person we're looking to hire, is gotten that experience. Because when you're a biotech coming in to see us, you want somebody that's been through a few of those battles, wherever they be, in pharma or biotech, and it's helpful. Yeah.
Ron, I was also going to ask, you do mostly human pharmaceuticals, or do you work with animal health products or plant science? Or?
We do maybe 15-20% of our work might be in veterinary drugs. Just got a letter from CVM yesterday about a method we had developed. So, you know, there's we don't do right now so much in, say, plant science, but it's a very interesting area for us because we see there are a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. We look for proteins. How do we look for proteins? We look through, you know, tryptic hydrolysates or direct detection, whatever the case may be. It's just a different matrix. Yeah.
That's probably a question for Alan or Michael, but when you think about platform technology, and it's an overworked word, but in the context of diagnostics, I've often wondered why imaging, micro diagnostics, and the information that they produce are not coalescing and platforming in a way that could really fall at the point of care, especially.
Yeah.
A pretty major effect. And to be provocative in terms of getting as close to the patient as possible, thinking about a platform, there is work going on, as you guys probably know, in adjustable pill single cell analysis, where very specifically in the microbiome, the pill goes to that part of the gut where cells can be taken by the pill. Mm-hmm. There's an RF antenna on the pill, and the data goes up into the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
It's a combination of chemistry and optics. And I kind of see, you know, companies like, especially Siemens, with imaging capability and chemistry capability, being an ideal, you know, layer of that type of platform.
Yeah, it's quite a mystery why. When we put Siemens in diagnostics here, we thought that imaging was going to be the area, and a lot of handheld cell scope devices, to get pathology onto a slide and then get it up to a cloud. Why doesn't that work? I mean, why didn't the CTC program work? It's the signature that you're getting is not, there's not enough biological information, and it still requires real heavy analytics on the pathology side to automate a pathologist. Like Alan said, and I was really surprised by that number, that there are so few pathologists. We don't have a pathology bot yet that works. There's a lot of art to that. And even high throughput path smears, are probably the closest that we've come. But it's basically signature. There's just not enough information, and there's a lot of art to deciding if a cell is pathologic or not.
I would say that it's social and cultural as well. So, and it's changing. But in the past, for us to sell an analyzer or a device, we talk to the laboratorian, who is essentially concerned about the turnaround time, quality of the instrument, quality of the result that comes out of the device. And that was the purchaser, the economic decision maker. I think with the consolidation, and that purchaser didn't care about radiology. Mm-hmm. And I think with the consolidation of the healthcare system in the United States, it's most hospitals, most practices are now integrated into integrated healthcare delivery systems, and the purchaser has moved from the laboratorian up into the C-suite. These integration discussions now have traction, and I see them happening. We are in great fear of Siemens that they'll get their act together and combine precisely precisely what you're talking about. But there's also another issue with both pathology and radiology. Those are still free texts, mm-hmm. right? So every other laboratory test is a number, and you can put it in an algorithm, but there's still an emphasis on, beautiful floral descriptions of what you're seeing on an X-ray. And Watson and IBM are spending a lot of time and energy trying to shrink those back into a coding system so that computers can work on them. I think what's going to happen is, in the previous practice that I was with Karis, the pathologists actually were shrinking their descriptions down into code so you can apply them to machine technology. But that's the other issue. So you don't want a colonoscopy.
It's an unmet need.
Right.
Okay? It's disruptive.
Uh-huh.
Even though it's, somewhat proved.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Get emerging technologies,
yep.
Make an adjustable pill.
Mm-hmm.
Now you don't need to go through that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How many have done 23andMe or some version of that? My wife and I, that was our Christmas present to each other. How many,
mm-hmm.
I mean, again, you're seeing people start to to your point, you know, they're doing it out of curiosity. Well, the colonoscopy obviously is for health reasons, but a lot of people are doing it out of curiosity to start with. But that's a, you know, that's a process. That's a business model. That's a way to generate biological information that's yours that, you know, over time you can think about how that evolves to be all kinds of things. So we're at time. I'm getting the from the back there. So can I have a warm applause and thank you for Ron from AIT, Mike, and Alan. Again, I know each of these guys pretty well. They're terrific. They're, you know, if you've got questions, I'm sure they'll be, you know, sticking around a little bit. Feel free to contact them at their place of work. And again, I really do appreciate the time. You guys really are experts at what you do, and hopefully that came across. So I'd just like to finally thank our sponsors, Miles Communication and Indie Science Connect. And Suzanne, thank you for sending out that email. Please provide us your feedback. Again, this was kind of our first deep dive into science. I don't know if it went too deep, not deep enough. Did we try to cover maybe too many topics? Again, your feedback is very important to these kinds of things. And you can see from that earlier list, I know there's going to be a couple that we're going to really focus on, particularly microbiome, big data, this convergence notion of how technology and informatics is merging with the life science. So if you've got feedback, please share that with Lori and Mary Jo, or Joe Bass, sorry. And anything else?
Thank you.